Welcome to Faithfully Working, a podcast from Christ Church in Grand Rapids. I'm your host, Addison Hawkins. Here at Faithfully Working, we like to think, read, and ask questions about how faith in Jesus impacts our everyday work. Our hope is to help God's people consider the many callings in their lives through resources, conversations, and of course, God's Word. We continue today with our third episode in our series looking at Work and Worship, a book by Corey Wilson and Matthew Kamick. We've been working through this at Christ Church in our Sunday school, which we call Adult Institute. So I'm just going to hand it over to Dan Churchwell, who will take it from here.
Thanks for joining us for week two of our work through the book Work and Worship by Matthew Kamick and Corey Wilson. We do have more books. I know some of you have already picked those up. If you don't have your, does anybody know where the box, you have it, Andrew? So Andrew has the box of books. Raise your hand, Andrew, one more time. He has the box of books. So if you still owe $5 from picking one up in the last few weeks, please do that. Or if you'd like a book, go ahead and grab those from Andrew at the end. And again, this is all in preparation. Some of you might have been here Corey Wilson is actually a professor at Calvin Seminary, and so he was here. We did a little short introduction and Q&A 2 weeks ago, and then he'll be here as a bookend to culminate the talk here in a few weeks. So we thought we'd take these 4 weeks to work through the book itself and just prepare to think about it in a deeper way, and then he will be producing or interacting with us in a seminar the Saturday before the Sunday as well. So you'll see the posters around church. They're yellow and black. They look a lot like this. And I think it's been in the bulletin, etc., for sign up for that Saturday event with the co-author. It'd be really great to have you join us. Well, let me open with a word of prayer and we will jump right in. Lord God, I thank you for the opportunity to talk about this topic. I thank you for the beautiful weather, the snow in Michigan in January is gorgeous. Thank you for the opportunity to worship together. Lord, we're bringing all of our lives centering on you into one place. Thank you for the co-authors of this book and the opportunity to think through their ideas, to be provoked, to challenge, and to agree and disagree, and just engage the ideas that they're bringing to us. Thank you that you have blessed us with an abundance of riches of ideas and thoughtful people writing on these topics. May we be salt and light, as we heard this morning in the sermon, and may we be doers of the word, not hearers only. In your name, amen. All right, many of you have already been in my classes before, so you know I love interaction. Please do interact with me. We're doing chapters 4, 5, and 6 today, 4, 5, and 6. Hopefully you had a little bit of chance to go through those. Really kind of provocative. There's some provocative stuff in these three chapters. I'm just going to file a caveat. Your outline is pretty limited. I finished my study yesterday because unfortunately I was in the hospital for 3.5 days this week. So my week was a little truncated. And when we get near the end, if those of you who read, he talked about rage psalms in the book. Did you guys get to that? It's a pretty funny little part of the chapter. I had a little bit of a rage psalm week. So it's my back and neck have been giving me fits. Monday, I was sent to the, I was doing physical therapy. She did something to my neck and gave me immediate double vision. So I had like really weird eye symptoms. And so I won't bore you. And then I had to work through the hospital because they immediately think you're stroking out when you go in with eye problems. And so they have to do this whole stroke protocol before they actually get to the issue at hand. So I had a very interesting week. But I finally got to the material. That's your outline is a little truncated. I didn't go as in-depth in your outline just for time's sake. But I had a blast studying yesterday because all I can do is pretty much sit in a chair with an eye patch on. So the double vision is recovering, and praise God for good healthcare workers. I had really great care, and I really got to see, I was on a COVID floor, unfortunately, but I got to see a lot of what the medical community is going through. I've been obviously steeped in this study, and I was just able to watch and see what people dedicated to their craft have to go through, especially now during COVID. Not only just I respect the medical profession already, but what a weird 2 years. And so, unfortunately, I got to see firsthand certain people practicing their vocation in a way that's fairly difficult at the moment. But what we get to talk about right now for these three chapters, 4, 5, and 6, is this idea of, from the Old Testament, how does work and worship correlate, or how do they connect in the Old Testament? And so for the introduction, largely this is just simply chapter 4 is the introduction. Chapter 4 is really great. It's short, but a really good integrative connection for the Old Testament. So largely, though, I boiled it down to just simply two ideas. Chapter 4 is essentially in the Old Testament, the God of the Pentateuch, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. It shows a life of deep integrity. In other words, the God of the Israelites wanted his people to see that there is a very clear horizontal and vertical perspective on life. That you can't, being out of whack, being hyper-spiritual or hyper-pietistic or very materialistic, you know, this vertical versus horizontal is a wrong way to think about it. You have to think how they intersect directly. And that this is not merely an intellectual solution. That's come up in the book 3 or 4 times. We as Presbyterians, we love good theology. We have an amazing backlog of good theological writings and thinkers and a lot of history with good ideas. But in the Old Testament, what you see is that the spiritual and material were understood to be constantly intermingled. So you have this deep integrity. And remember, we talked about integrity, the word, the idea of integer, wholeness. Integrity is a major value for the God of the Old Testament. And I'm using that language, you know what I mean? He is the same yesterday, today, and forever. But there's a different conception, the Jewish mind, the Torah, how they wrote about it, especially the Pentateuch. There's unique angles and ways in which they approach these topics. If you want to think about it in a New Testament version, just this is Romans 12, 1 and 2. You know, do not be conformed to the pattern of this world. All of us live in a certain kind of zeitgeist. Really, the Germans always have those good words, right? This is zeitgeist, the spirit of the age. That's what a zeitgeist is. There's always a spirit of the age. And if you're a student of history, you'll realize that there are different things that are emphasized during different periods because we're affected by things differently. And so getting our mindsets back into the Old Testament mindset, the Torah, the Pentateuch, is kind of a difficult thing to do. It takes some intense thoughtfulness. But the one major thing in the introduction, I want you to know, and this is largely out of chapter 4, is that the God of Israel wanted his people to know the spiritual and material worlds had to be understood as constantly intermingled. In other words, he is an earthy God. We talked about this last week. This is like the incarnation. God was sent to us in a mess, you know, as a baby into the world. And so we then open up this idea of integration. We talk, and the authors jump right into chapter 5, the Pentateuch. So the first point in your outline is the Pentateuch. The Israelites, you know, you have Genesis, the interesting stories in Genesis, but they start largely with Exodus, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. They play a lot in Deuteronomy and a lot in Exodus. But this concept of the, they use and riff off the story of the Israelites being liberated from Egypt and the idea of Sabbath that came from that. So Does anybody have, if you have your Bible, would somebody open to Deuteronomy 5? Deuteronomy 5 for me. And we just want to read this concept of Sabbath real quick. It's the fourth commandment of the Ten Commandments. And as somebody is turning to Deuteronomy, you remember the Exodus, right? The people of Israel were held captive in Egypt. They were essentially slaves doing the work largely of construction and agrarian work. So you have they did 7 days a week. They were making clay bricks. They were working in the households of the wealthy Egyptians, and it was just constant work. This might be a little different orientation than some of you. When we hear these stories, sometimes we hyper-spiritualize them. But if you think the authors are trying to get us to put ourselves in the place of the worker, the place of the real Israelite, the real person. I love Lord of the Rings. I love C.S. Lewis. I love all these. You know, you can read all kinds of great stories, and sometimes we get affected a little bit. I think fiction should be I'm not one of those guys who think we should only read nonfiction and only books about Jesus. You know, that's not who I am. I'm fully the liberal arts kind of guy. I love reading story and narrative, and I think there's real good concepts that we can learn from good fiction. But this isn't fiction. This isn't Frodo. It's hard for us to say, okay, there were hundreds of thousands of people enslaved by another country, God's chosen people, 7 days, just trying to think about the rhythms of what their life was like for generations. And so putting our minds in the eye of the Exodus, what is the Exodus? What did it mean? And then you have this whole group of people leaving that lifestyle. So again, this is generations. Habitus, there's habits. When you're raised, there's a generational poverty is talked about. Well, there's generational wealth. We're affected by our generations that we have. You know, either way, wherever you're on the spectrum, we're affected by the generations that go. The sins of the father is another way of thinking through it, right? So that on one level, this isn't super difficult, but it's a hard time. We don't put ourselves in this. We don't have enough time to sit back and reflect a lot, I find. And so there's generations of slavery, generations of 7 days of work, generations of being oppressed. And all of a sudden, God of Israel comes. The Passover, right? We know the crazy stories of the frogs and the da-da-da-da-da. And then they're released from that. Well, that being released obviously was a good thing, but they bring pathologies, histories, remembrances with them. It's not like your past is wiped. And so one of those habits of work, habits of overwork, habits of working 7 days a week, habits of being oppressed are hard to slough off. And so that is where the co-authors are bringing us into this conversation. And they even bring out in Deuteronomy 5. Who has Deuteronomy 5? Anyone want to read for me? Would you read Deuteronomy 5, 12 through 15, please? Thank you. So I want you to not forget this. If there's one thing that I want you to remember today, this was fairly new to me. I mean, I've read this. I grew up in the church. I've heard this a lot. And this was the first time in my mind I was able, that they helped me connect the idea directly to the fourth commandment is a clear reminder, the connective tissue of the idea of why it was so essential. It was because remember when you were doing 7 days a week being oppressed. This is not that. I am a God who sees you, who hears you, and knows you need rest. For some reason, that was just new to me. I've read it before, but the clear linkage, it's because of the Exodus. Remember where you came from, and this is why this is different. Even down to their servants, that litany of reading that, it's not just you chilling out. It's think about the rhythms of your work, your servants, the people that are connected to you, the stories you're teaching your children. rest. And on page 70, I think this is going to be a little bit of, I mean, I could probably do 2 or 3 weeks on this. I find it highly provocative. On page 70, this idea that comes out of this topic, especially in the Old Testament, the idea they would put monuments up when they would cross rivers. There's multiple stories. They would create monuments of remembrance. And in the Old Testament mind, the concept of memory or remembrance, the temptation to forget what the Lord has done, is a very clear temptation. And I would argue it's even more important to think about the idea of forgetfulness in our age for many reasons. We are pulled in different ways. The technology we have, the speed, the efficiency, the way the world works at the moment we have now is much more complex, but we bring the same kind of human nature to it. And so the idea of slowing down and thinking about the Old Testament, particularly the Pentateuch, and thinking about the Exodus and what Sabbath means is really important, just as important for us as for the Israelites. Because we have been habituated in a certain kind of work. I commend highly to you the writings of Derek Thompson. He's a chief editor in The Atlantic, and The Atlantic is one of the longest-running magazines of opinion and commentary in America. I think 1850 is when it started, The Atlantic. Derek Thompson, young guy, writing, but really perceptive on the concept of technology, future of work, workism. He wrote a seminal article in 2019 that is referenced quite a bit. It's in The Atlantic. You can find it. I think they allow you 4 articles free. And it's called "Workism is Making Americans Miserable." And it really did turn into a seminal article. It was right before COVID, right before this last 2 years. And again, his name is Derek Thompson. I really do commend this to you. It'll take 5 to 8 minutes to read. But it opens with the classic. I was familiar with this before, but I just want to read the opening. In his 1930 essay, "Economic Possibilities for Our Grandchildren," John Maynard Keynes predicted, a famous economist, probably the economist that has more ruling over your life than you understand. John Keynesian economics has affected America over the last 90 years tremendously. And so John Maynard Keynes predicted a 15-hour work week in the 21st century, creating the equivalent of a 5-day weekend and a 2-day work week. He writes, "For the first time since his creation, man will be faced with his real permanent problem, how to occupy himself with all the leisure." And it became so popular that in 1957, a New York Times writer, Eric Barnow, predicted that as work became easier, our identity would be defined by our hobbies and our family life and these other ancillary things, not work. And while other countries, this particular article is focusing on the American worker and the religion of workism, and largely in the white-collar space, generally, statistically, we do work less hours in aggregate, that is true, than a generation or two before us, but the white-collar set works 20 to 40% more hours. And this concept of burnout, and I know the last 2 years has turned a lot of things on its head, the type of work, what we do, etc. But it's a provocative, poking, prodding article. So we still deal with these kinds of workism. Is work, we as Presbyterians, right, we're directly connected to the concept of the Protestant work ethic. If you don't work, you don't eat. Good work. You get up, you shovel. I mean, this morning I exhibited a good, I'm not Dutch, but I'm taking some of those, on, and our driveway was completely clear of snow this morning. My son and I were out, even with my arm, I like to at least push a shovel, look like I'm doing some work, but largely I'm bossing my son around. And teach, and we were just clear. Done, I love it, like first on the neighborhood, neighborhood bonus points. And we work, everything is about the Protestant work ethic. Everything, if the harder you work, the more you'll be blessed. And again, that's a whole different class, a whole different subject, but it's intertwined in what we do. How do we think about work and wealth and rest, especially in the modern age? And a lot of that stems out of the footnote on the bottom of page 70 that provoked me, especially yesterday, this idea of Sabbath connected to the fourth commandment of Sabbath, connected back to the Exodus. But the authors, talk about the first footnote there, the importance of memory and the temptation to forget are seen clearly in Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy as a whole indicates that the way to retain land and freedom, and the caution is they must retain and celebrate the memory of God's acts in their lives and give thanks, and in other words, understand where their true life lies. The abundant life and freedom God has given can be lost, and this is what Deuteronomy seeks to guard against. In my studies yesterday, I just stopped and thought, what kinds of memory are important? What kinds of memory are important? We have four kiddos, and the older they get, the more, as they face different things in life, our daughter is driving. Dad, how did you learn how to drive? And those questions that come up, if you have children, that they're interested in your past. What were Grandma and Grandpa like? Walk uphill both ways. All the how you grew up. They want to know. They want to be attached. So obviously, personal memories, memory of your life individually, are important to pass on. But there are also memories. So that is not exactly what's going on here. Those are important, but what the theological frame that we need to think about is the communal historical memories of the people of God. I do have personal stories, I think, how God has answered prayer, how God has worked in my own life, and I can give, some anecdotes personally, and that goes only so far. But it's being connected communally to a people and participating in the ups and downs and the history of the life of the church to see how God has worked in and through time immemorial. Because my life is only 45 years long. And sometimes I can only remember the last 45 minutes of what I'm doing, right? The older you get, the more you walk into a room and like, why am I here? What am I trying to be getting? Here for? And so thinking through communal historical memory, just the act of coming in and being reminded like we were today, this concept of salt and light, and trying to put yourself in another perspective. His joke about salt, right? How many of you, if you looked in your pantry, how many kinds of salt do we have, right? It's a condiment. It's something we hardly any of us ever think about. My wife's from Montana, and you can get some really good Montana red, there's a place that you can mine, and there's only two places in the world you can get this certain kind of salt, and one of them is in Montana. So every time we want to get this Montana red salt, because it has like four other nutrients that the other, other salts don't. It's just kind of silly. But we don't think, I had the chance to teach in Germany for a month several years ago. And one weekend excursion, we went to Salzburg, Austria. Salzburg, salt. It was the fortress city on the river protecting the chief economic, it's like oil in Saudi Arabia. Salt in Austria, the salt mines all around that German-Austrian border, that was the chief economic port for salt. It was so imperative to have access. It was currency. Salzburg, Austria. Most of you are like, oh, Sound of Music. But that's where it was filmed. But this concept of Salzburg, up in the fortress, there's a fortress that overlooks the city, and we got to tour it, and it was one of the only fortresses in that area that was never conquered. You have to take a funicular up into it. I mean, it's amazing. And so this concept of remembering that how I live now, the things that impact me, are generational. And having a memory and to remember, why is this memorial important? I know we have memorials behind here. Why do we go to cemeteries? Some people think cemeteries are creepy, largely because of the horror movie, you know, genre. I suspect the hand's going to come out and grab you. But why do we put up monuments to our loved ones? Why do we remember? There is, yeah, that is conceptually, absolutely, the Ebenezer idea in the Old Testament. So again, for some reason, I'm just inviting you into how my mind was working yesterday, and it might be the pain meds, but I was just struck with the idea of how much we do not remember. We forget, and God is saying, don't forget. Remember who I am, and remember in your daily work. And that the ways he wanted us, so this is why this matters, is because one of the ways of remembrance is the economy, the average daily work that you and I interact with, our daily humdrum, mundane, ordinary lives, the work we have. Israel's economy was supposed to be distinct, set apart among the nations, strange even. Their peculiar working patterns were meant to set them apart from all that surrounded Zion. That's on page 73. This idea of being set apart, we hear that in the New Testament, and we kind of hyper-spiritualize, it has a very theological meaning. But again, remember, the vertical and horizontal were not to be separated. They're integrated. And so this concept of set apart, the God of the Old Testament saying, look, it should manifest itself in our daily walk. And one of those ways of showing is the trust in how you worked your fields, how you allowed the certain work day practices, the ebb and flow, to show those around you, I believe God, because he says, if I take a rest day, I will not fall behind. He is the God of the Exodus. And so clearly they're saying, look, it will be a witness, a testimony to those around you, how you work or don't, as in the Sabbath, the rest. On going on in the bottom of 73 to top of 74, what does it look like bringing work to worship? On the bottom of page 73 there, when you have entered the land, take some of your first fruits, put them in a basket, and the priest shall take the basket from your hands and set it down in front of the altar. And you shall declare, the Lord has brought us out of Egypt, gave us the land flowing with milk and honey. And now I bring first fruits of the soil to you, Lord, that you have given me. Place the basket before the Lord your God, bow down before him, and then the Levites and the foreigners residing among you shall rejoice in all the good things the Lord your God has given to you and your household. So this concept of first fruits, how many of you are familiar conceptually or have heard that before? This idea of first fruits, right? It's fairly common. Any kind of talking on giving, usually it comes out. But it went like this, you know, and largely it's an agrarian society, right? Coinage was fairly rare, especially in the Pentateuch age. Coinage becomes a little more popular. They did have silver ingots, which we'll get to in just a second. Silver was primarily a kind of currency, but largely currency was your animals, your livestock, your grain, your olives. And right now it's hard. 1.6% of Americans have any kind of integration into the agricultural world. So this is foreign to us. And again, you have the opportunity to put yourself in another person's shoes. But it's hard to realize first fruits in a more pictorial, earthy, material way, because we're like, where's my phone? I forgot to tithe. Beep, boop, boop, beep, boop. And I tithe. In fact, my mind just went, I'm like, I wonder how we, Christ Church, give our money. So yesterday, and again, it probably was the drugs talking, but I asked myself these questions, and I reached out to a few people on a very short notice, and they kindly got back to me. But this is how we tithe at Christ Church, percentage-wise. 2% is cash, 56% by check, and 42% electronic. All currency, though, obviously, right? You're with me. The currency, 2% cash, 56% check, 42% electronic. And I would doubt that 42% would go down. It's probably going to go up in the future, electronic giving. So it's hard. We don't have that earthy, material idea of saying, here is the basket of my olives, my grain to you, or the bull, or the lamb, or even for the poor, the bird, right? The offering of the bird. And for a lot of this, the first fruits, the Levites and the poor did share in some of the spoils, because the Levites didn't have land. They didn't have, right? They didn't have the ability to cultivate. Their calling was to the people, and so they shared in the benevolence, the giving, the tithes, offerings of the people. But largely, what if you read the book or you know this from the Old Testament, what were those first fruits? They were offered to God, and what happened to them? They were incinerated. They were burnt. Burnt offering. We've probably heard that. But this was the concept of God, again, reminding, as you cultivate your fields, as you raise your flocks, as you prune your olive trees and create olive oil, as you do these things, take the first fruits as an offering, as a thanks to God, as a reminder. For what reason? What is the reminder or the memory that is trying to be invoked here with this concept of first fruits? Everything we have came from him. Absolutely. What else? That's totally. What else? There are several things. Yeah. Absolutely. The memory of the connection between slavery to owning the property and cultivating it. Absolutely. What else? Boom. The ongoing provision, the understanding, the trust, the rest. Good. So all things come from God. The concept of remembrance of the slavery connections, the concept of the ongoing goodness of God, the idea of our first fruits, and then them being, I mean, your best bull. And what was interesting in the book as well that jumped out at me was the concept that the priest was largely not involved. For those of you who read, you remember, I mean, it was the priest was not the person able to say, this sheep is actually the first, this is the one without blemish. They're like, no, it was up to you. There was an element of, you know what your best work is. And I was trying to conceptualize this, because it's hard for me to think. I work, let me rephrase, because I work at a think tank. It's easy for me to think, but largely we think in statistics or data or spreadsheets. Here, God, here's my Excel pivot table. It just doesn't seem the same, right? You know, so I was trying to say, what would this look like in our lives? Because we reduce it to currency. And the concept, and obviously we need currency to live, right? We just passed the budget. We're starting a new year. Obviously we know how that works. But that's not the point. The point is offering the first fruits of our labors back to God because of his character, and remembering and trusting and believing that he will say and do what he has promised. And I would argue, I think that having a mere currency related world removes us more than offering up a commodity that we have grown and produced and cultivated. It's a little easier because we do it every day. The Israelites weren't constantly incinerating their best calves, right? But think about my son's birthday. He's not in here, is he? No. My son's birthday is coming up, and just the other, I want to get him this. I know we came from the Pacific Northwest, and he loves Gonzaga basketball. The GU, you know, the Bulldogs, if you're familiar with the college basketball, we came from Spokane, Washington, and so I just found him a really awesome sweatshirt and got him, being here, it's like, are you green or blue? You know, are you blue and yellow? Are you Michigan State here? And he's like, nope, I'm a Bulldog. And he's had that conversation with his friends. I love it. And so I'm going to get him a really nice sweatshirt. But we think about how Amazon, boom, boom, we just buy. Think about it, it's just all electronic. We do it. And here it's just another thing. Oh, beep, send the church my money. Oh, well, Keynes, absolutely, yeah. So this was 90 years ago. I mean, so that's why the article, we don't have time to get into the article, but this idea of Keynes, I mean, Derek Thompson, irreligious, he's talking merely about work and economics, but it is an interesting, it's culturally related, is a provocative piece. But what we see now is that this idea of currency and the speed of the market and we live by efficiency. And God is saying, look, efficiency, we could all work 7 days a week. Why do you not have a third job, you lazy bums? Come on, pick it up. Right? There's a hauntingness of American culture about work that takes the concept of the Protestant work ethic too far. And I could, if you're interested in it, that's provoking to you, or now you don't like me very well, we could talk about that more. Because there's a lot of, we could have a lot longer conversation about that. But the concept of rest and Sabbath and giving of your first fruits was tied to this idea of memory, theological understanding of who God is in practice in your daily walk. And just very shortly, I want to, in my work at the Acton Institute, we had the opportunity to go out to Walla Walla, Washington. Walla Walla, Washington, if you know central Washington, the main agricultural engagement out there, apples, cherries, and pears. And there's an orchard out there that's the second largest contiguous orchard in America, and it's called Broche Orchards, named for Cheryl, I forget her, Ken Broche. They started about 60 years ago, and if you've ever had any apple product from Costco, you've had Broche Orchards. But they named their company First Fruits. And they have 7,000 contiguous acres of apples and cherries right along the river there. It's fascinating. And they have, work with me here, 12 million square feet of packaging and processing. We got a tour of their brand new automated, this was 3 years ago, their brand new automated 1.1 million square foot automated processing center. The whole place is run by 12 people. It's 1.1 million square feet. They were experts in cryogenically freezing and understanding the apple so that apples could, like the apples we eat now are largely last year's crop, not ones that were picked this last fall. They were picked a year ago. And it was fascinating, understanding. But the reason we were out there, I mean, I love a good apple and some cherries, right? That's fine. The reason we were out there is because who picks our apples? Who picks your fruit? Did you have fruit this morning? Last week? Who picks our apples? Migrants. I'm going to go real, white people don't pick your apples. They just don't. We don't do that work. And they begin to see the deleterious impacts of the cyclical, and do apples grow 24/7, 365? I mean, different parts of the world they do, right? Globalization, yay. But they're the trees have a very natural order. And they realize that how they were bringing in workers, I mean, 1,700 to 2,000 at a shot. 2,000 migrant workers were working there, 2,000. And so they named their company First Fruits. And you can go Google this, it's all over. It's a pretty famous Christian story in philanthropy now. But they invested over $120 million. They built a city, and in Walla Walla, Washington, and Walla Walla is kind of in the middle of nowhere. And then you have to drive about 45 minutes outside of Walla Walla to get to the 7,000 acres. And they built a city. They put in a $60 million neighborhood so people could have a house and a neighborhood and schools. In the middle of nowhere, they created a community. And then they invested that. They're like, look, we find first, second, and third shift family destroying. And so they figured out a way with cryogenics and the different, the reason the innovative, the juices that drove the innovative power of Broche Orchards were because of how do we create good working environments for the people. They eliminated the third shift. Because families that you couldn't get a rhythm, you couldn't, I mean, and it's just line after line, and I don't have time to go, this isn't a commercial for Broche Orchards necessarily, but they have shown as a company, it's apples and cherries, I mean, or agriculture, right? Thousands of years old. But they realize and thought through the processes, who it all affects, how it affects it, profit, bottom line, first fruits, giving to God, and they're the one, number one immigrant lobbyist firm that they support lobbying and immigration, fascinating studies on what immigration and the needs. I mean, they've put their money where their mouth is. And they called their company First Fruits, and it follows. You can, I mean, it's just clearly an example of a multi-centimillion-dollar business that follows these principles. So it's not impossible. But it is rare. It is rare. All right. Yeah, we got 6 minutes left. So, lastly, I'll land this on this Psalm Pentateuch part. What they're trying to remember is that it's about not atomized individuals. In America, modern liberal, and when I mean liberal, I mean small L, not liberal versus conservative, right? You know, the liberal humanity that came out of the Enlightenment, what it means to be a free-thinking people, the individual, the atomized individual. Who am I and how do I create what I can? And that is the ethos of our day. That is the spirit of the age. And what the Old Testament helps us shake free a little bit, or tries to, is that it's about community. It's about creating a culture. It's about integrating these concepts that we learn in church and bringing our work to our church. We can't separate the two. I shared my story of my hospital. I can't separate that right now. I got shoulder pain right now, and I got just a little bit of that double vision still right now. I can't separate that. It would be silly to. Those of you, you're bringing pain from your work. Maybe you had the heck of, maybe you had a good week. It's the end of the year. Maybe you all got some bonuses and you're all like living it up. whatever ebbs and flows, the memory that there are cyclical natures in what it means to be human, good and bad. There's differences by degree. Some of you are bringing your joys, the first fruits of your love, and life is just humming. It's an 80s rock song, right? It's good. You got the car, the girl, and it's just a good time. That might be your life right now. But some of you might be the 90s country song where, you know, I rolled my truck and my dog died and my girlfriend left me, you know, the whole nine yards. You're somewhere in that cyclical nature. And the authors of this book are trying to tell us, to shake us free of the concept that you can't or shouldn't bring the outside world into worship. They're like, it's just nonsensical. You bring that with you. It's not unspiritual to be having a bad day. What it is trying to get us the connective tissue to see, what does God have to say in the midst of the mess of the life? Whether it's just mundane and ordinary, whether it's bad, or whether you're on cloud nine. What is God doing in your world to help you remember his work? Oh, for sure. Yeah. Yeah. No. You don't have it against the book. I'm just going to, because they state that right out in that first chapter, right? For the, this would be a 900-page book. So your critique is totally true, right? Totally right on. But there's no, yeah, you're 100% right. And they believe that there is all kinds of work outside of paid work that we should reflect on. But they limited the scope of this book to our paid work just for the size of the project. So but yes, that reminder is totally needed, because from the kids in school to people retired and coming out of work, leaving the workforce, but still working in many ways, absolutely this still applies. Those of you who are still with me, the Pentateuch chapter, I will end with page 84, just the concept, the trichotomy of the emotional, ethical, and theological reason for feasts. Did you read this, some of you? The feasts. What I love, and I'm going to end with this, because you got to all go get your kids in 3 minutes, and I'll deal with the Psalms next week, because that's powerful too, really powerful. But I want to end with this. I want the feasts in the Old Testament, the cyclical nature, and the community building. How many of you read this feasts part or engaged with this Pentateuch piece? I mean, it is so interesting. And about the only thing I can think of is in the bulletin today, it said next week's a potluck. Right, for when we do Wednesday, this coming Wednesday is a potluck. But they said part of giving of your first fruits, some of it is incinerated, but then all throughout the year they had different festivals. It was party time. And they would bring their good works according to their stature and socioeconomic status. And if you had nothing to bring, you were still able to come to the table. And largely it was bring your grains and your wines, but if you didn't, take your silver, the ingots, it says this right in the text, take your silver, take it, and turn that into something for the party. And what they mean by party, they meant a party, a festival, food, libations, fireworks, the whole nine yards. It's the Lord of the Rings. The first, when all the hobbits are sitting around and the fireworks are going off and they're all partying. The ebbs and flows, the cycles of life, God says you must celebrate with others, with that community. Celebrate out of your storehouses what you have, convert what you have, and share what you have, in a way that reminds us that we are not our own. All that we have is not to be guarded and protected and kept. So this concept of the harvest feasts on page 84, they say there's four main things. The first benefit of the harvest feast is emotional. It trains a community of workers to enjoy the goodness of God and taste the flavor of work well done. There's an emotional benefit to harvesting first fruits. The second benefit of a harvest feast is ethical. The Feast of Tabernacle, for example, focuses our attention not simply on the fruits that sit on top of the table, but on the co-workers and neighbors who sit around the table. Be joyful at your festival, you, your sons and daughters, male and female servants, Levites, foreigners, the fatherless, the widows who live in your town. For 7 days, celebrate the festival of the Lord your God at the place he will choose. For the Lord your God will bless you in all your harvest, in all your work, and all your hands, and your joy will be complete. Let's do a 7-day festival sometime, right? Let's party. Let's do that. But it's ethical because you're sitting around with the others in the community, seeing and hearing about their daily work. It's not hyper-spiritual. It's about their daily work. It's celebrating with them about the harvests that they have had, or lamenting. And then finally, thirdly is the benefit of the harvest is a theological one. Yahweh, not the worker, is the host of the feast. Yahweh, not the worker, is the economic origin, essence, and end, or purpose, of the community's work. Yahweh, not a pagan fertility god, is recognized as worthy of praise. The Israelites wrestled with two major things coming into Canaan. First, the suspicion that the harvest was the result of their own hard work, and secondly, the suspicion that they had received the harvest from some spiritual source other than Yahweh. So their idea of festival, of party, of giving of their first fruits was evangelistic in its own way. They were saying, look, this doesn't merely come from my hand, the self-made man. I hate that. I hate it. I'll fight against that for the rest of my life. There's no such thing as a self-made man or woman. It's insane. And I mean that, the proper sense of the term. It's insane to think of a self-made man. But yet that's the mantra that we believe in America. And this is one of those clear ways. If you read this chapter, this should disabuse us of that concept. It's God's. God creates the rhythms. God gives us the strength. God gives us the opportunity. God created the sun, the moon, and the stars, and the trees, and the ability of our brains, our rationality to think, to create. It's God's. And he wants us to participate and remember that he is the ultimate cause of those things. I find that beautiful, needed, and a reminder that we can bring our daily work into the church. We can pray and we can offer these things largely for the memory and the remembrance of who God is and what he says he will do. Emotional, ethical, and theological. Let us learn how to feast again together on these concepts. Lord God, I thank you for the Pentateuch. I thank you for the Old Testament. A lot of us are unfamiliar with much of what it says beyond some of the stories. Help us to sink our teeth into the meat of your word, to study, to grow, to provoke, to be incensed, but to think and to live and to act on the things that we're learning. God, I thank you for the ebb and flow of life. I thank you for your character that you allow us to lament. I thank you for the character that you promise that you will provide our needs. And I thank you for a church where we have good people working in everyday life, whether they're 3 years old 85. All work is empowered by your hand. May we learn and listen and quiet our hearts to understand how to best give the first fruits of our labor to you and those around us, and that you honor that. May your name be praised. Amen.
I hope you enjoyed the episode. If you did, please consider giving it a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Google Podcasts. If you want to go a little bit deeper, you can check out our show notes for more. Or you can go to our website, christchurchgr.org, where you can find our Faithfully Working Hub, which is our ministry for faith and work. If you're looking for a community where you can engage with your work and how it impacts or is impacted by your faith, we'd love to have you. I'm Madison Hawkins. We're Faithfully Working. We'll see you soon.